Good afternoon. Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming here today. It is my pleasure and privilege to welcome Professor Lord John Krebs as a Messenger Lecturer. Cornell Messenger Lectures were established in 1924 by a gift from Dr. Hiram Messenger, Cornell, 1880. The objective of the gift was to bring to Cornell, I quote, "the ablest non-resident lecturers obtainable," end of quote. The generosity of Dr. Messenger's gift has indeed enabled Cornell to bring to campus some of the world's leading scholars and public figures. These criteria certainly apply to today's Messenger lecturer, Professor Lord John Krebs. Lord Krebs obtained his doctorate with DPhil, being in Oxford, in 1970, studying the effects of behavior on great-tailed population in Whiteham Woods. It's therefore fitting that he is today Baron of Whiteham. As such, he is a member of the House of Lords, where he chairs the House of Lords Select Committee of Science and Technology as an independent crossbencher. His important contributions are both to science and to society. He can be considered the founder of behavior ecology, and his two textbooks on the subject with Nick Davis have been used worldwide for the past 30 years. When elected to the Royal Society, he was its youngest fellow. Further to memberships of many learned societies, including the Academia Europaea and the US National Academy of Sciences, he has received 15 honorary degrees. He is the only biologist, to my knowledge, who has served as a president of both the International Society for Behavioral Ecology and of the Association of the Study of Animal Behavior. He was knighted for services to behavioral ecology. And when the British government was confronted with BSE, mad cow disease, they created the Food Standards Agency and asked Sir John to serve as its first chair. He resigned after 5 years in 2005 to become principal of Jesus College, Oxford. Today's lecture, the first of three, is on risk, uncertainty, and regulation. Please join me in welcoming my friend and colleague, John Krebs.
Thank you very much, Andre, for those kind words of introduction. I felt quite tired when I heard all the things that I am supposed to have done. I should say that it's a great pleasure to be back at Cornell and see so many old friends here. I've been here many times during my academic career, but mainly then as a behavioral ecologist, whereas this time I'm talking about my life since I moved from academia into public policy. And I'm going to give three talks that are interlinked and deal in general terms with the topic of risk. I'd hope that there was nobody in the audience who was an expert on risk, but I know there's at least one person in the audience who gives a course of lectures on risk, so I'm now a bit nervous about what I'm going to say. But what I want to do in today's lecture is to talk about what we mean by risk. How good are we at appreciating risk? How much risk is acceptable in our lives? We all think that life isn't risk-free, but how much risk should we be exposed to? And whose job is it to manage risk? Is it up to us to make our own choices? Or as the newspapers in England often say, someone should do something about it, meaning presumably the government should introduce regulation. So those are the sorts of themes I want to introduce today, and I'm going to illustrate as I go through with some examples drawn from work that I've been involved in and others, my colleagues have been involved in the United Kingdom, but I think the principles and the examples will have resonance here because the general underlying points are universal. So let me start off with a very simple question, what actually is risk? Well, it sounds straightforward, but if you think of some everyday sentences in which you use the word risk, you can see that it's used in many different senses. So here's one. I don't know whether there is a train to Cornell, but if I were giving this talk in London, I would say that I didn't come by train today. There was a risk that the train wouldn't arrive because the trains in England are unreliable, and that's really about uncertainty. I wasn't certain that I'd get there. On the other hand, the folks in this picture who like skydiving, they do so because the risk gives them a thrill, and that's not about uncertainty in the same way as the risk of the train not turning up. That's something to do with danger. On the other hand, if you're a football fan in Europe, you will be aware that the European finals are due to come up in 2012, and if you're living in England, you wouldn't put your money on England to win Euro 2012. In fact, there's a risk they'll be knocked out in the qualifying stages, and that's risk in the terms of probability. There's a chance they won't get there. But you may also, if you're somebody with money to invest, you may decide to put it in something very safe, like a bank account with a deposit interest yield that's very low, or you may decide to speculate on the stock market and even invest in startup businesses. And if you do that, you may say, well, there's a risk, but the returns could be very large and the returns make the risk worthwhile. So in that sense, risk is about variability. And just to complete the picture, and this is not an exhaustive list, think about a current topic that I'll come back to a little bit later on, nuclear power. A lot of people say, well, I wouldn't want to live near a nuclear power station. It's too risky, setting aside events in Japan. Mostly that's not about the actual statistical probability of something going wrong and the impact of that something going wrong. It's about dread, a fear of the unknown, which I'll come back to later. So my first point is that risk means many different things to many different people. If you go to books, because there are a plethora of books on risk, and here are just a few of them, and look at the definitions that the authors of these books use, you get even more confused. So Ulrich Beck's book, The Risk Society, is one of the classic works in social science of risk, and he describes risk in the way that that top sentence does. A book by Hood et al. On the government of risk, how is policy meant to influence risk, gives a rather different definition. Gert Gigerenza, in his book Reckoning with Risk, talks about learning to live with uncertainty. And then this book by Bernstein about risk in the financial sector has, again, a totally different definition. So my first challenge in describing how we live with risk is to understand what we're going to talk about when we talk about risk. And what I'll be talking about is a conventional use of the word risk in relation to safety, which is the likelihood of an event happening multiplied by its impact. So something that has a low probability but a high impact could have a similar risk index as something that has a high probability but a relatively low impact. So let me now turn from what risk is to ask you to set yourself the task of judging risk. And there is a large literature in behavioral science about how bad all of us are, and I'm not accusing you of any particular fault, I'm just as bad as you are, how bad we all are at making use of evidence about risk. And I'm going to just illustrate with a few examples. I'm not going to go through all these, and they're not an exhaustive list, but I'm going to talk about, first of all, how information presented as probabilities can lead us to misleading judgments about risk, the so-called base rate fallacy, which can lead to misleading judgments, and I'm going to talk about dread and the unknown. I won't talk about framing as gains or losses. So here you are now. You've got to pretend you're a medical doctor, and this is based on a real-life study of medical students at Harvard University carried out by Eddie some years ago, and the hypothetical case is this. There is a form of cancer that affects 1% of all the patients that come into your surgery. This is a fact you're given. And there is a test that you can send these people off to have, and the test is not perfect, but it detects 80% of the people who've got cancer, it detects the cancer. On the other hand, it also has a certain level of false positives. It gives a 10% false positive response. So it's a bit more accurate than the test for prostate cancer, the PSA test, but it's still not a very accurate test. So somebody comes into your surgery and you wonder if they have this particular hypothetical cancer. You send them off for a test and the test comes back positive. And you, the doctor, now have to tell them what's the risk. If you ask Harvard medical students, this is the answer they give. They say the risk that the person has actually got the cancer is 75%. The probability is 75%. That's wrong, as you will all have spotted. It's very wrong, in fact. Look at it in terms of frequencies. We know for 1 in 100 patients coming to your surgery will have cancer. Of those, 0.8, 80%, will test positive if sent off for a test. On the other hand, of the 99 who don't have cancer, if they're sent for a test, 10%, 9.9, will test positive. Therefore, a positive result is 0.8 over 9.9 plus 0.8 is 7.5%. So that's one example using risk as probability of how we might be misled when we receive information about risk. Here's another one also related to cancer. There's a lot of debate in the UK and maybe here about the efficacy of breast cancer screening. And it does indeed save lives, but how many lives? In Britain, there's a program, I don't know what the situation is here, but every woman over the age of 50 is automatically called on a regular basis for breast cancer screening. And if you look at the information that often is referred to in the press, it tells you that breast cancer screening reduces the risk of dying from breast cancer by 25%, which is a whopping risk reduction. But think about what does that mean in terms of lives saved? How many lives are saved by screening 1,000 people, 1,000 women? The answer is you can't tell. You haven't been given a crucial bit of information. And that crucial bit of information is what the prevalence of breast cancer is in the population. Without knowing the base rate, you don't know what this 25% is 25% of. If you do actually have those numbers, this is what it looks like. The death rate is reduced from 4 per 1,000 to 3 per 1,000. So the 25% is going from 4 to 3. And if you turn that into increased life expectancy, breast cancer screening does help. It increases life expectancy by about 12 days, which is about the same as reducing your car driving by 300 miles in a year. So this is a way of looking at risk in context. And my third and final example of our judgment of risk comes from a very extensive series of studies carried out by, particularly by Paul Slovich at the University of Oregon, on the phenomenon of dread and risk. And what he does, or has done over many decades in his work, is to present people with different hypothetical risks, like being shot, being run over, being exposed to radiation, biotechnology, and he asked people to rank these risks in their severity, their subjective ranking, and then he does a factor analysis to figure out what the underlying explanatory variables are that account for risks that people think are big or small. And the answer that he and others have derived is very simple, that people, including us, tend to rate risks as high if they have two particular features. One is that they are unknown, so we can't see them, don't have a good understanding of them. And the other thing is if they're out of our control, involuntary, potentially catastrophic. So if you look at the top right-hand quadrant up here, the things that come out as perceived as having high risk, DNA technology, radiation, pesticide residues, are things that weight highly on being unobservable and poorly understood and uncontrollable and involuntary. Things down here, riding a bicycle, smoking cigarettes, and downhill skiing, are rated as under your control, they're familiar, and so they're rated as having a lower risk, even though, statistically speaking, the things down in this bottom left-hand quadrant would have a much higher risk of adverse consequences and occurring than the things in the top right-hand corner. So, given that risk perception and risk reality may vary, is there any way of quantifying risks in terms of magnitude of impact and probability of occurrence that allows us to make an objective comparison? And one such person who's done that is the Canadian scientist Václav Smil, whose book may be familiar to you, Global Catastrophes and Trends, published a couple of years ago. And what he does is to say a way of comparing risks would be to calculate the mortality per person per hour of exposure. And now just sitting here, exposing yourself to my lecture, you have a baseline mortality rate, which is about 1 in 1,000,000. And then you can compare that if instead of sitting here you went out for a drive or you went out to smoke a cigarette or you got an aeroplane and flew to Boston or New York or somewhere, how would your risk increase? And here are some of the figures. So you'd increase your risk by 1% by taking a flight, by 50% by going for a drive, for an hour's drive, and double your risk by an hour smoking. So that's one way of objectively comparing risks. And my colleague in Cambridge, the other university, David Spiegelhalter, has come up independently with a similar index of comparison, which he calls the micromort. And here, just to give you different modes of transport, how many miles, this is a way of comparing the safety of different forms of transport, how many miles can you travel per micromort, per death per unit time of exposure? 250 miles in a car, 6 miles on a motorbike, 20 miles on a bike, and 15 miles on foot. So that gives you a relative index of how safe it is to travel in different modes of transport, how risky it is, in other words. So this Smil, in his book, generates some interesting comparisons using this index. For example, the risk of being affected by a terrorist attack is 3 orders of magnitude less than the risk of simply driving around in your car. The risk to U.S. and civilians and military personnel during the Iraq War was 1 order of magnitude lower than being a black male walking around in Philadelphia. And although 9/11 was obviously a great tragedy, the risk of exposure in the Smil index was less than the risk associated with 2 weeks of hospital errors in the United States. Translating this kind of comparison across to energy generation, and this is apropos nuclear energy in Japan, this I say very approximate because I'm not sure I totally trust this. It comes from this website. But this is an attempt to compare the death rate per terawatt hour of energy generated from different kinds of energy source. So it includes both occupational and public risks. And you can see that coal, which has both occupational risks and public risks exposure to polluted air, is much more dangerous as a source of energy than oil, much more dangerous than natural gas, and in turn much more dangerous than solar, in turn much more dangerous than nuclear. So even though people have become nervous about nuclear energy as a result of what went on in Japan, if you look at the harsh facts, it still remains, relatively speaking, a very safe way of generating energy. And here's another way of looking at nuclear risks, power generation risks in context. So it's estimated by the United Nations that the excess deaths that arose from the worst nuclear accident ever, Chernobyl, is 2,000. That's the UN estimate. In the southwest of England, in Cornwall, people live on granite rock that emits radon, and the estimate recently published in the British Medical Journal is that by living on granite rock in the south of England, that contributes 1,000 excess deaths per year from cancer. And these are not deaths, but the excess cancers in the USA that arise from CT scans, because so many people are given CT scans, is estimated to be 29,000 per year. So again, in thinking about risk, it's important to think about a broader context. So what I've said so far is that risk may not be all it seems. I now want to switch briefly to talk about the role of the regulator. So if you are in charge of managing risks on behalf of the public, what should you take notice of? Should you take notice of what people think, or should you take notice of what the experts advise you are the estimates in scientific or statistical terms? One way of looking at that question is to ask, to kind of reverse the question and say, if we look at existing regulation, how many lives are saved per dollar spent as a result of that regulation? because you would think a kind of reasonable judgment would say we should spend roughly the same amount in order to save a life in domain A and in domain B. And here's a study from the United States which says that the implicit value for per fatality is how much money it costs the public purse or industry to save a life as a result of the introduction of a regulation. So introducing seatbelt and airbag regulations, the implicit value is $0.1 million, $1 million per life saved. On the other extreme, regulation concerning exposure to formaldehyde has an implicit value of $256 million per life saved. So there are some great discrepancies in the way regulatory regimes reduce risk in terms of the cost per life saved. Interestingly, and there's a whole body of literature about asking the public, people like us, what we think the government ought to value a life as. And that's quite remarkable. It's called the study of willingness to pay, and there's a remarkable consistency. When you survey different groups of people in many different contexts, the answer comes out, people think it's worth spending between $2 and $9 million to save a life, and the comparable figure in the United Kingdom is £1.25 million, so we're a bit meaner than you folks. And this number, I don't know what happens in the US, but in the United Kingdom is explicitly used by, for example, the Department of Transport when they're engineering a new road intersection, a highway intersection. They could spend more money to make it safer, but when the marginal cost of expenditure exceeds £1.25 million per estimated life that would be saved, then they stop increasing the safety. So there's a specific use of this willingness to pay in order to determine how much safety to engineer in the lives of the UK motorist. In rail transport, there's also an explicit number, which is somewhat larger than road transport, reflecting the fact that people are more scared about accidents over which they have no control, as I showed in the research of Slovich and others. And part of the reason for these discrepancies is because politicians react in a knee-jerk way when risks emerge, but it's partly to do with factors other than safety or risk reduction coming into political decisions. And if I take the most effective piece of legislation on this chart, which is introducing seatbelts, seatbelts were made mandatory in the United Kingdom in 1983, and in the debate in Parliament, when this legislation was passed, here are some of the people who spoke against it. It's a wicked, evil, horrific bill that offends the Ark of the Covenant of a Free Society, and ill-informed, illiberal do-gooders who want us to put on seatbelts. And here were some of the arguments that were used against it, that people are good drivers, it's uncomfortable for women, it's uncomfortable for small ladies, interestingly, unsuitable for pregnant women, and so on. So these were not arguments to do with actual risk reduction, but arguments to do with freedom of the individual to choose whether or not they wish to expose themselves to risk. And that comes back to the question of whose job is it to manage risk? Is it at them out there, or is it us ourselves? Interestingly, nowadays, nobody quibbles about seatbelts. I don't know about in this country, but in the United Kingdom, it's not an issue. So although it was a huge issue 30 years ago when the legislation was introduced, it's now become commonplace and nobody argues about it. So I now want to switch really to talking a little bit about science and policy. And my starting point, this short section of the talk, is this, I think, very appropriate quote from The Economist just over a year ago. In talking about climate change and what should policymakers do about the science of climate change, and the point they made was that science often deals with ambiguities, uncertainties, and politicians who have to make binary choices, do or don't do something, want certainty rather than uncertainty. And nowhere could that be more explicit than in looking at what the Danish Prime Minister said to the group of scientists who went to Copenhagen ahead of the Copenhagen Climate Summit. And he said, as you can read, we've got to make the decision, and I want to give you a piece of advice. I want fixed targets and certain figures. I don't want any of this stuff on uncertainty and risk and that kind of stuff. So there is a clash here between the culture of science and the culture of politics, which is central to many of the difficulties that arise in translating scientific advice into policy making. So if science is not about providing certainties, about providing facts and figures, what is it about? And here are two, I think, very good definitions of what science is about. Richard Feynman, some 40 or more years ago, said science is the organized skepticism in the reliability of expert opinion. And my Oxford colleague, Bob May, more recently, I think, gave a slightly more elaborated description of science as a landscape with small hillocks representing competing points of view, which may over time evolve into sharp, as he calls it, spiky mountains of areas where we have extreme confidence about scientific facts. But in other cases, we'll remain with this landscape of competing points of view represented by small hillocks, and we can't be certain which point of view is right or wrong. And that concept of science is obviously one that's quite difficult to get across to policymakers who say to the scientific experts, well, give me the answer. And if you say, well, there are different points of view, that's not terribly helpful, but that is often the reality. I now want to, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but I now want to turn to some more concrete examples to lend some flesh to this rather abstract set of ideas. And the first one is to elaborate on that last point about experts disagreeing. Now, we all as scientists are not surprised that experts disagree. After all, you know, if you go to a conference and present your latest results, the likelihood is that somebody in the audience is going to try and rubbish them and tell you, actually, no, we disagree, we've got contradictory results. So experts disagreeing is not unusual in the scientific community, but it's immensely difficult for politicians to cope with. And I want to give you an example of that from the United Kingdom that cropped up about 4 years ago. And it relates to this question, which I'm sure is an issue here as well. Should people living near farms worry about drift of pesticide sprays, the so-called bystander effect? And there are groups of people in the United Kingdom, lobby groups, who claim that many folks are made ill by inhaling minute quantities of pesticide that drift off fields into their homes and gardens. And because the UK is a very densely populated country, many people live near farms or travel near farms that are sprayed. So here are the figures from the United Kingdom. It's a small country. We have 4.6 million hectares of cultivated arable land, and between 1 and 1.5 million people live next to fields. 253,000 kilometers of paths and roads are right next to fields, and on those fields, 30 million kilograms of pesticide are sprayed or dumped per year. And depending on who you believe, they do or don't have adverse effects. So the pressure groups say that many hundreds of people each year are affected, and they're affected in two particular ways. They develop something called chronic fatigue syndrome and something called multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome. And neither of these are well understood by the medical profession, but the people who suffer from them really believe that they are important illnesses. The regulatory agency, the equivalent of the EPA, called the Health and Safety Executive, says that actually, this was their figure given in 2003, that the number of people adversely affected by pesticide spray is somewhere between 1 and 14 out of the million or million and a half people that live close to farms. So it depends on who you listen to as to whether you think there's significant risk here. So the government decided to seek further clarification from experts. And the mistake they made was to ask two different expert groups. which was bad. They asked one expert group called the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution, which is chaired by a very distinguished ecological colleague of mine, who many of you will know, John Lawton. And what they did, looked at all the evidence, and they said, yes, it's plausible that there could be a link between pesticide exposure and these two forms of ill health. And they said the government ought to take a more precautionary approach and have a cordon sanitaire of 5 meters around each field so that the drift of pesticides doesn't get out into people's homes and onto the road. And they were particularly concerned about lack of data on the assessment of exposure and lack of good toxicological data. Unfortunately, at the same time, as I say, the government asked another group. There is, I don't know how it works here, but there's a statutory expert committee that is meant to determine the advice that underpins policy in relation to pesticides. And that's called the Advisory Committee on Pesticides. And they said, well, actually, the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution's recommendation is disproportionate, and the toxicity is very unlikely to contribute to these two illnesses. And the reason that the Royal Commission reached the wrong conclusion is they didn't consider the evidence properly. And it wasn't that this group was a group of second-rate fly-by-night scientists chaired by a very distinguished medic from Southampton University, Professor David Coggan, and all serious experts in toxicology. So here you are, you're the Minister for Agriculture with responsibility for a decision. You've sought advice from the experts, and sadly for you, the experts disagree. Well, what is underlying this if you dig beneath the surface? What underlies the difference? They do agree on two things. One is that there is considerable uncertainty. It's one of these areas of science where there is a landscape of opinion, and there isn't a single, in Bob May's terminology, steep, spiky mountain. There's a paucity of data. And therefore, what constitutes an appropriate response, a proportionate response, proportionate to the risk, is a matter of judgment. It's hard to come up with a definite answer. But where they disagree is whether the toxicology takes account of the uncertainty and whether there's consistency, and this goes back to my comment about regulatory consistency, consistent with other areas of risk management. Also, what weight should be given to public perception? If people out there are worried, should the policymakers say, fine, there's no real risk, but we know you're worried, so we'll do something about it? And then there was a question as to what these epidemiological data actually mean. If people are claiming they've got some illness, what does that mean? Can a cause be attributed to it? Does the illness really exist? So, I mean, I was glad that I wasn't the agriculture minister having to make a decision in the face of that, but it illustrates, I think, it's a specific example, one of the difficulties of translating scientific advice into policy. Now, that this case is a genuine disagreement amongst a group of experts. But in other cases, that kind of uncertainty has been exploited in a ruthless way by industry to undermine the regulation of risk in the interests of public safety. And there's a super book, which if any of you haven't read, I well advise you to look at, by Naomi Oreskes from California, called Merchants of Doubt. And as the title indicates, it's about how the industry harnessed a small group of scientists to fuel doubt about the adverse health consequences of smoking and a range of other things to prevent regulation being introduced. And she refers to what she calls the tobacco strategy, which was used initially by the tobacco industry. They hired particularly two physicists, one of whom was a former president of the National Academy of Sciences, Fred Zeitz, and the other Fred Singer, to fuel doubt about the link between smoking and cancer. And they succeeded through that strategy of preventing regulation for many decades, when they knew themselves, absolutely without any doubt, that smoking causes cancer. They then applied it to regulations related to passive smoking, environmental smoke. They then applied it to different industry to acid rain, ozone, and finally, in the current world, to denying climate change. And the strategy, the tobacco strategy, is to emphasize that there is uncertainty in the science, that the concerns are being exaggerated by the scientists that are saying there's something to worry about. In any case, given time, there'll be a technological fix, and get the regulator off my back and let me carry on my life as I wish to. So that's an immensely, it's a powerful read, and it's an immensely, I think, sobering demonstration of how the misinterpretation of science, in this case fostered by, for various ideological reasons, by a small group of scientists, can interfere with appropriate protection of the public from risks. And this is what Oreskes and Conway say in summarizing. They say, doubt works, and it works in part, and this comes back to Bob May's definition of science, because of an erroneous view of science. If you think as a policymaker that science is all about certainty and facts, and therefore someone can say there isn't certainty, minister or secretary of state or whoever, then the science is probably faulty or incomplete. But as she says in the bottom paragraph, echoing very much Bob May's view, science produces evidence, research produces evidence, which may, over time, accumulate into one of these spiky mountains, at which point that is accepted scientific knowledge. There's a consensus, and that's what knowledge is. There may be outliers, as in the case, I don't know how serious this was in the United States, but one medic in the United Kingdom called Andrew Wakefield persuaded parents that the measles, mumps, and rubella triple vaccine caused autism on the basis of no scientific evidence, and he was sufficiently skillful in his media presentation to persuade many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of parents not to vaccinate their children with the triple vaccine, as a consequence of which those diseases have dramatically increased in the United Kingdom over the last two decades. So that's exploiting this notion of doubt and preying on the fact that people don't understand the nature of scientific knowledge. And I want to turn to a second example, which is one that I was personally involved in, I have been since 1997, in which the government came to me and asked the scientific answer to a question, and the answer was, we don't know, which was a bit alarming, but I'll tell you the narrative as it unfolded. And it may seem odd that I start this story here in the Italian landscape between Siena and Pienza at the Abbey of Monte Oliveto Maggiore. The reason I started there is I went on a walking trip in Italy a couple of years ago and discovered that this in this monastery there are some wonderful frescoes painted by a 16th century Italian artist Giovanni Bazzi, who was nicknamed Il Sodoma for reasons that I don't probably need to explain. But the important thing is that here he is, a self-portrait in one of these beautiful frescoes with his pet badgers. So he loved badgers, as many people in the United Kingdom do. However, badgers, as it turns out, are a problem in the United Kingdom. And the problem is this. The most important livestock disease in the United Kingdom is bovine tuberculosis. And for many decades, the government has been trying to develop a strategy to control this disease, which is steadily increasing throughout the United Kingdom. And they had known for since the 1970s that there is a wildlife reservoir of this disease in the badger. And the government, over a period since the mid-1970s up till the mid-1990s, had been tinkering around with the idea that if the badgers have got the disease, if we kill badgers, we can prevent transmission to the cattle. And in 1996, they came to me and said, is this policy scientifically justified? And together with a group of scientific experts, we looked into the evidence and we said, although it is clear that badgers are a wildlife reservoir and it's clear that they do transmit the disease to cattle, we simply don't know whether killing badgers is going to be an effective control policy. We can't tell from the data. And what you, the government, needs to do is an experiment to find out. And somewhat to my amazement, the then government, which by that time was Tony Blair's Labour government because there'd been a general election, they said, OK, we'll do an experiment. And it is probably the largest field ecological experiment ever done in the United Kingdom. And what they did was to, under the recommendations of my report, was to identify, this is a map, by the way, of the southwest of England. This is Cornwall and Devon and Dorset, and this is Wales here, South Wales. And these shaded areas are the areas where bovine tuberculosis is the biggest problem. It's spreading gradually up into the central and northern parts of England, but its major problem is here in the southwest, which happen also to be the major dairy-producing areas, because the soil in these parts of the country is too poor to grow crops, so it's mainly dairy and, to some extent, beef country. So within these areas, what they did was to identify these different regions, each 100 kilometers square, 10 kilometers by 10 kilometers, and they divided each of these regions into three zones. In one zone was a control where nothing was done. The badgers were left well alone. In the second zone, whenever a farm had an outbreak of TB, they went in, the agriculture ministry went in and killed all the badgers on the farm by trapping them and then shooting them. And in the third treatment, it's called proactive culling, they went into these 100 square kilometer areas and they carried out a scorched earth preemptive policy of wiping out all the badgers that they could over a period of 5 years, sustained killing. And they looked, the dependent variable was the prevalence of TB in cattle. And the results were extremely surprising. In the area where they did, these were unfortunately became known in the media as the Krebs trials, which I was not happy about. But the reactive culling, killing badgers when there was an outbreak of TB on a farm, resulted in the five-year period in a 27% increase in the amount of TB in cattle. The proactive culling, on the other hand, did indeed reduce the amount of TB inside the culling area, but it had a puzzling effect of increasing TB in cattle just outside the affected area. So this, it was absolutely right to say the science can't tell us the answer when we set out to do these experiments, because the answer was completely surprising. Hadn't expected it at all. Well, what's going on? Well, luckily, there are people out there, including David MacDonald in Oxford, who study badger behavior in great detail. And here's a kind of cartoon summary from the Wildlife Trust, an NGO, which explains sort of what goes on. So basically, if you cull out animals for an infected area, you get movement of new animals in, because badgers are normally territorial. You break down the territorial system. The new ones that come in either are infected themselves because they're the wandering sick who don't have a home territory, or if they're not, they immediately pick up the infection from the environment because the bacterium, Mycobacterium bovis, survives in the environment and is sniffled up, and they pick up the infection and then spread it around. And because the territorial system has broken down, badger movement increases, so the disease is more likely to be transmitted to cattle. So this is the so-called perturbation effect. Now, this massive culling trial took place between roughly 1999 and 2004, but in the subsequent years, the data have continued to be collected and analyzed. And things have changed a bit over the time period, but if you summarize now, during the trial, these were the figures I've already showed you, inside the cull area a decrease, outside an increase. If you look at the post-trial period, this decrease seems to have been sustained, if anything slightly increased, although not statistically significant, and the increase outside seems to have faded away, probably as the territorial system settles down. If you add up for the 9 years' data, the effect is minus 28% inside, plus 9 outside, so the overall effect is around a 15% gain. So the answer is, if you kill badgers in a scorched earth approach, you'll reduce the prevalence of TB in cattle by about 1 in 6 or maybe 1 in 5 herds. So it's a pretty small effect for a pretty large effort. And the Labour government, when this was these results were reported, decided that culling wasn't the policy. Then we had a general election last, I should say, well, is there anything else you can do? There are two other things you can do. One is to increase biosecurity, either by keeping badgers away from cows or by keeping infected cows away from uninfected cows. And the other thing you can do is develop a vaccine, which they are now trying to do. So that was the Labour policy. When the coalition came in after the election, they looked at it and they reversed the policy. They said the evidence shows that we ought to go ahead and cull badgers. So here are two different political groups taking the same evidence and drawing exactly the opposite conclusion. And what, I won't go through that one, Nature said about this late last year was the fate of badgers may not be the most pressing issue facing UK researchers today, but the way the government has handled its approach to scientific advice will leave those who promote evidence-based policy feeling anxious. Now, there's still a bit of limbo here. I spent 2.5 hours on the phone on Monday to the people in the Ministry of Agriculture trying to explain to them that the science wouldn't support the policy that they are now forced to adopt by their ministers, and we'll wait and see what happens. It's still, the jury is still out. Just to emphasize that misunderstanding of badgers has got a long and honorable past, this is a book by Sir Thomas Browne, the 17th century medic, on called Vulgar Errors. And what he says here is there's a common perception that badgers have their legs longer on one side than the other, and this is the received opinion agreed to not only by inexperienced people but also by those who've observed them and hunted them daily. So the idea is that badgers walk along hillsides and they have the down the hill legs are longer than up the hill legs, and Thomas Browne himself looked into this, and he used the principles of truth, authority, sense, and reason, and concludes that there was no difference. And although the left side was supposed to be the shorter leg side, he couldn't observe it. So perception of badger biology and reality has been a problem ever since the 17th century. And I want to briefly turn to my last example, which is perhaps the most blatant example, in my view, of politicians ignoring the evidence. And this is a particularly UK issue. I'm not sure whether it's such an issue here in the United States. But one of the major social problems and increasing health problems in many British cities is excess alcohol consumption and the consequent social and health issues that arise. And 2 years ago, the government's chief medical officer, our equivalent of the Surgeon General, looked into this, and he said what the government needs to do, looking at all the evidence, is to increase the minimum price of alcohol, because the evidence shows that that will deter people who drink to excess. What's happened in the UK in the last 30 years is the minimum price of alcohol has declined dramatically relative to people's earnings. So it's incredibly cheap compared with when I was a student. What did the politicians say? Well, here are the spokesmen from the three political parties, Conservative, Labour, and Liberal Democrat. We've no intention of going ahead with anything like this. Important to deal with people's attitudes and not just supply and price. Don't want to impose additional burdens on the majority. So it went down like a lead balloon, and that's the way it stands at the moment. It's not that the politicians were unaware of the harms and costs, because their own the Cabinet Office, their own central strategy unit, looked into it, and here are the costs in terms of crime, loss in the workplace, healthcare costs to the National Health Service, and in terms of victims, this is a particularly striking figure. The government's own estimate is that 1 million children in the United Kingdom are adversely affected in their health and well-being at home by excessive drinking by their parents. But in spite of that, they said, we are not going to do anything like increase the price. What we're going to do instead is to introduce a strategy which is about information and education. We'll have more police on the street. We'll ask the industry to put warning labels on bottles, which they do, and we'll provide health treatment for people who are drinking to excess. Even though the World Health Organization, having looked at all the evidence across all countries, said the three crucial measures to curb excessive alcohol consumption are availability, taxation, and marketing, and then beyond that, effective enforcement. How big is the evidence base to support that? Well, here's a paper published a couple of years ago, well, a bit more than 4 years ago now, looking at 1,003 estimates in 112 studies, looking at price elasticity, showing very clearly that public policies that raise the price of alcohol are an effective means of reducing excessive drinking. So this is a case where the policymakers don't like the evidence. And why don't they like it? It's not to do with public perception, it's to do with the interests of the drinks industry, who have a powerful sway in the policymaking world. So finally, my very last couple of points before I close are about the communication of risk. And this is an immensely challenging thing. Even if you understand as a policymaker what the risks are, how do you present that information to the public in a way that balances a reality about what the risks are and a sort of framing of the presentation that doesn't cause people to be either unduly concerned or unduly complacent? And a classic example at the moment is, for the last 10 years, is how do governments talk about the risk of terrorist attack? It's something that has a low probability but a large consequence. How do you present that to people? Do you say you should go around being nervous all the time, or that you should travel normally and not take any notice of it? Neither of which are exactly right, and it's a great challenge. So I just want to give a couple of illustrative examples of good ways of communicating risk. And here's one that may be relevant to some of you. I don't know whether you are on statins. What are the risks and benefits of taking statins? And I'd be interested to know whether any of you who do take statins have ever seen this way of presenting the risks. And this is based on 2 million GP as a general practitioner, general medical practitioner, 2 million records of medics. Out of every 1,000 men, how many develop illnesses over a 5-year period? And here are the 1,000 men in blue, and the ones on the left here, as you look at it, are people who didn't take statins, and the ones on the right are the people who did take statins. This is heart attack, that's esophageal cancer, acute renal failure, cataract, liver dysfunction, myopathy. By subtracting the left from the right, you can get the net risk and net benefit, and it looks like this. So sure enough, taking statins reduces heart attack risk because there are more red men on this side without statins than on that. Reduce the risk of esophageal cancer. On the other hand, it has certain disbenefits. Taking statins increases the risk of cataract, liver dysfunction, and myopathy. So here's a very clear presentation of risks and benefits, enabling you as an individual to decide which way you want to go. That's one example. My second example is, I think, the best communication of risk and uncertainty that all of us experience. I experienced yesterday when I flew into Ithaca. It's a little safety card that you get when you get on an aeroplane. And if you think about it, what is that saying? It's saying flying is not risk-free, because otherwise why are we talking about what to do if the plane goes down over the sea? It's saying, you know, things may go wrong, but we have an answer. The answer may actually be a bit unrealistic if the plane does go down, but it gives you the impression they're onto the case, because the things will drop down and the life belts will pop out and you'll slip out of your high heels and trot down the aisle and go off the slides and so on. So it's a way of saying we're not guaranteeing that this is completely safe. We're telling you that we've got a plan if things go wrong, and we're being very upfront about it. And it doesn't make people panic. I didn't notice everybody pouring off the flight from LaGuardia to Ithaca when the girl stood up and announced to all three of us that there was a likelihood of the plane coming down on the way. So I think that's a very effective way of communicating risk. And my final slide is about communicating uncertainty. And this, I think, is also quite nice. This is used in a totally different domain. This is about the Bank of England. So the Bank of England has to regulate certain aspects of the macroeconomy in the United Kingdom, like interest rates, and they make projections. And this is the way this shows you about the, for any economist in the audience, I apologize, this is the science of economics. So the red line is measured data. This is consumer price index. That's the index of inflation. And this was in February 2010, projecting out in the future, and they're saying, well, basically by 2011, we haven't got much idea of what inflation is going to be, and we've got no idea at all 3 years hence. But that's kind of being honest. It's saying, you know, we're pretty uncertain about things, and that's a way of, I think, a good model of how to represent risk and uncertainty. So to close, just to conclude, I think for scientists who end up like me at the interface between science and policy, the challenge is to communicate to policymakers what the nature of science actually is and what it's meant, what it means to say, here is a scientific fact, here is scientific evidence, and to include in that risk and uncertainty. And the challenge for policymakers is to turn what is often a fuzzy picture, a frustratingly fuzzy picture about the evidence, into what often has to be a binary decision. We either do or don't kill badgers, or we either do or don't increase the price of alcohol. You can't say, well, we're not quite sure, so we'll just do something fuzzy. And that is a real challenge in the interface between science and policy making. So that's all I wanted to say for today. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
British government system. But I've not seen any evidence for it. And so I'm wondering whether you implemented it at the Food Science Center, whether you know that anybody else did.
Yeah.
And my second question is I was applied to be on a government committee to look into to give advice as a scientist. And I was, if I remember right, I was given, I was asked to sign a piece of paper. So I didn't. Given to the government.
Yep.
And so I asked, I said, what does that mean for me as a person to be responsible for government advice about food safety?
Yeah.
And they said, well, not to worry. Parliament and society waived that.
Yes.
Okay. So as a scientist, you know, at some point the government decided that scientists should be responsible for the advice.
Yes.
And then somebody else had decided, we don't like that.
Yeah. Well,
So your first question was when should the assumptions underlying scientific advice be made transparent? So here is our advice, and here are the assumptions we've made in coming to that conclusion. And clearly it should, and most of the time I think it is. Certainly it was when I was studying the candidates, laid it out very clearly. But that, I think, is important to both the public in sort of, well, what did they assume when they said that X was going to be an effective way of managing risk. It's also important for the more intelligent policymaker, minister, to understand what the assumptions were and what the uncertainties surrounding those assumptions were. So that's the first part. The second question was, if independent experts provide scientific advice, to what extent are they responsible? Should they take out some indemnity insurance against being sued? I quite often came up against that issue, and my view was that, which I think is right, that the politicians are responsible for policy, right? So you can explain the advice as clearly and transparently as possible, but it's up to them to make a decision based on the advice, so you can't be held responsible if the people end up dying as a result of a policy decision. That was my view. But as you've seen in the examples I've given, advice is all too often a bit on the fuzzy side. So politicians are in a very different situation. But but I didn't know the detail. You said, well, Parliament has decided to waive this responsibility. I'm sorry, I just don't know about that. Yeah, for that.
So one of the areas in which we frequently do a poor job of assessing risks are the frequency with which very rare but catastrophic events occur.
Yeah.
Can you comment about sort of how we should handle those things from a scientific point of view?
Gosh, that's, I guess there are a number of levels there. One is an area of statistics, which is understanding the tails of distributions. So if you're trying to, you know, let's take a case like a major oil spill from a tanker. That is a very rare event, but when they occur, they have huge financial and environmental consequences. And I know from some work that I've done with the marine insurance sector that they spend a lot of time with statisticians trying to understand the statistics of the extremely narrow tail of a distribution to try and get a handle on the number. Beyond that, in the case that I was involved in, the question was this. So marine insurance companies insure shipping lines against disasters, some of which are very major but very rare. To what extent should they then hand that risk on to a reinsurance company, like Munich Re or Zurich? So they have to come to a judgment about how much risk they want to bear themselves and how much they want to hand on to somebody else. Of course, handing it on to somebody else comes pretty dear and pretty expensive because reinsurance companies are not going to be right. So they were trying to form a judgment about these statistically very rare events with very large consequences and at what point should you shift the burden of risk on somebody else? And the answer was, at least in the work that I did, there is no simple formula for doing this. It is, in the end, a judgment to happen. How much you're willing to bear the risk yourself, given that you know the very low frequency of occurrence of these events and low, you know their magnitude. So I'm not sure I'm being terribly helpful, but that's the only direct example I've had where people were trying to use rigorous scientific analysis to come to a judgment about a rare but very major risk. I guess it, in the end, was a judgment. Yeah.
Would you care to say something about the behavior of ecology, of human behavior that is, on the face of it, illogical? Somebody doing skydiving and then being upset if someone's smoking next to it.
Yes. You can invent some very nice just-so stories about why the dread risks are dreaded. You can think of, these are just-so stories. You can think about it's a selective advantage to be very, very fearful of things that you can't see that are out of your control, like a large predator lurking in the bushes that you are hunting, and therefore to rate those as very major risks makes sort of ecological sense. So I think you can, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that human beings are irrational. I would say they judge risks in a way that is different from the statistical or scientific analysis. There may be an evolutionary logic, which I think is what we're calling. But I'm not aware that anybody has kind of really analyzed that in a sophisticated way beyond the sort of just-so story that certain behavioral ecologists, none in this room, are prone to. I don't know whether you have a sort of better answer to that. So I think it's a good question. I think one, just sort of elaborate, one case which I think is amenable to some kind of more sophisticated analysis is the phenomenon of discounting into the future, which is pertinent to risk. So all animals that have been tested heavily discount rewards into the future. So having $5 now is much more valuable to you than created the indifference point between a small reward now and the possibility of a much larger reward later, demonstrates how steep the discount of the shape of the function is applied with one over x as a hyperbolic discount of the function. And you can sort of put an evolutionary interpretation on that in the sense that if there is a constant probability of death, then this reward in the future may never be reached. So you could sort of relate a hyperbolic discount of the function to a kind of death function. For people like Alastair Houston and John McNamara have modeled that in quite a rigorous way to provide the evolutionary logic for discounting of. So that's one particular angle on this, but I don't know where to speak about the gun. Yeah, there's one up there.
You had I'll start with a little comment on your airline story. A few years ago, I was on a British Airways flight, relatively small number of passengers, and here's how the staff appreciated the risk and the consequences. The cabin hostess put on her life jacket and said, "You wear this if you go down in the ocean, and here's a whistle. Beep, 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 beep. A lot of good that'll do you all if we land in the ocean."
She went off script.
That's because in a 747 in the cattle class, there were only three of us. But my question, you had a very nice chart of appreciation of the unknown.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask, why scientists are so ineffectual in Britain and Europe in removing the fear of genetically modified crops and food. I mean, here, they're all over the place. Even though the chefs in Manhattan will say they won't eat any DNA, we essentially all eat it. But in Britain, we've got some top molecular biologists, and speaking to them, they just throw their hands up in horror. How come you can't convince the politicians and the British public?
My answer to that is comes to Friday's lecture, where I should talk about that. The short answer, though, for those who are unable to attend or be put off by today, is that there was an incredibly powerful media campaign stimulated by some of the NGOs, Greenpeace and a group called Gene Watch, but really transmitted through the tabloid newspapers. The Daily Mail invented the phrase Frankenstein foods, and that had such resonance with the public that the retailers were the ones who ran scared. The retailers said, "We're not going to sell any food containing genetically engineered product." In fact, I'm almost sure that's not true. In reality, they are, but they don't claim to or claim not to. That's my brief story. There are lots of other currents in it, but I think that is the headline of the United Kingdom. In France, I think it's slightly different. That's sort of it's anti-globalization, anti-US sentiment in France. We want to protect our own local agriculture. We don't want these ugly global companies like Monsanto coming in and affecting our traditional cheeses or whatever. Even though cheese is often made with genetically modified rennets. This is not widely advertised by organic cheese makers.
Yeah. So, what can be done? What can we do? Do we need to read the behind the scenes of every report? Or do we just have a healthy skepticism for every report that we read? And then, what should be done on a larger scale too? Does the public need to be more educated? Does everyone need to learn about risk and statistics?
Well,
and Well,
that's, the answer to your first thing is be skeptical about everything you read. And one thing I discovered when I started being in the newspapers very regularly as head of the Food Standards Agency was that 95% of the things that were written about me or what I had said were complete rubbish. And therefore you think, well, what about all the other things that I know nothing about? I mean, there are people like me who are being written about and thinking, God, it's 95% rubbish. So that's first thing, you adopt an attitude of healthy skepticism. The question of educating the public is a tricky one because there used to be a sort of whole academic discipline, and there may be some people at Cornell doing this discipline, of the public understanding of science. And in the early days, say back in the 1990s and the late 80s when this discipline emerged, there was what was called the deficit model. The deficit model was the great unwashed public, unlike us, or like an empty vessel. And if you could only pour scientific knowledge into that empty vessel, everything would come clean. That model was held below the waterline by a wonderful study done by the European Commission Brussels, which looked at the then 15 member states of the European Union. And what it did was to, they did a survey work. They assessed this understanding of science by a member of the public. Things like, do you understand what an experiment is? Do you know what a control is? Do you know what the statistical significance is? And then they had a separate part of the study which asked people, how confident are you in scientific advice and information if someone says, the scientists tell us? And there's an absolute inverse correlation. Countries like Sweden and Denmark and Holland, where people know a lot about science and the way science works, are immensely skeptical. The countries who had a less well-developed knowledge of science, Greece, Portugal, Italy, were immensely confident in scientific advice and information. So that kind of caused people to think, well, if only you gave people more knowledge of science, they'd be okay. It caused them gave them pause. So I think the answer is very unclear. I think there are devices for communicating this, but I think three examples I've shown of the statins chart, I think, is a very graphic way of showing to people, if you're going to the surgery, the doctor says you want to take statins, and you're shown that chart, it gives you an immediate visual picture. And as I said, I think if you want to communicate that life is risk-free, what the airlines do, apart from the example of our colleague here, is a very good way of saying, life isn't risk-free, but we've got some way of dealing with it. I think there are devices, but I don't have a magic bullet. Professor Randall, you're allowed one small question.
You were actually in office during a reasonably positive time.
Yes.
What fraction of time were you facing events and decisions and you made recommendations based on time, limiting the risk and the fuzziness? Were you simply beaten over by the lobby?
Well,
because it's a big problem.
I think there was no case. I gave scientific advice which the government ignored, and that was partly because of a very unusual position that I had. Because of the BSE crisis, when the food standard was created, the head of the agency, IEB, had a quasi-ministerial position. So I sat around the cabinet committee table with ministers as an equal, but not in charge of making the final decision. So that gave me an unusual degree of authority. And I can't think of any case where they ignored my advice all day. There were a number of cases where they were horrified by what I intended to do and did their very best to tell me to shut up, including coming into my office and saying, the Prime Minister will be very upset if you go public with this particular piece of information. And I'd say, fine, I don't know. On the other hand, much more difficult is one's relationship with the media. And so, going back to the earlier question, whatever I said about the safety precautions related to genetically modified food would have no impact on the mass media who have taken anti-GM stance. All they would say is Sir John Krebs, comma, well known for his pro-GM industry views, comma, said. So that's the way I was portrayed. And so the media are a very important interlocutor between scientists and the wider public. Are we going to carry on for a couple more?
Yeah, one more.
Okay, so you've been waiting patiently.
A quick comment and a question.
in the chart of the various energies and the risk, you know, mortality rate, and that was, of course, always in detail,
publicly
included. So, for example, a local interest is actually using hydrographic technology. If the waste from that winds up in streams and causes public health risk, it may not be in there. So it's very important to know what that source includes. The quick question is, if you can assess the difference of culture, cultural risk, the culture of risk assessment and regulation in Britain, the EU, and the US, in broad brushstrokes, my understanding is that, you know, Europe has what we call the precautionary principle approach.
Yeah.
And the US is more typically when a problem occurs, then we'll try to regulate something about it. So, you know, do you see that? How much do you know about other situations here and how do you evaluate this?
Just to comment quickly on the first one, I agree. What that chart purports to show is the occupational risks, so coal miners, but also the public risk. So many of those 161 deaths per terawatt hour are people who suffer from respiratory disease and die as a result of inhaling exhaust from coal-fired power stations. But I agree with your general comment. If you really want to dig into it, you've got to ask what risks, who's bearing those risks, and
what might have left out on this other one.
And the solar, you may say, well, what are the risks associated with solar PV? That is almost entirely, as I understood it from the website, the occupational risk of people falling off roofs while they're installing solar panels. So you're meant to make a good point. The cultural differences, the first thing I would say is there are huge cultural differences within the European Union. And of the European member states, the United Kingdom is generally more like the United States than most other European countries. So in the case of GM, for example, when the European Union proposed new regulations on labeling GM foods, and people wanted to avoid this toxin could do so, two member states voted against the regulation. UK, because we thought it was farming, and Austria, because they thought it didn't go far enough. But most member states said, yes, it's right that people should have the choice to avoid genetically modified, not just food with genes in it, but products that contain extracts like corn syrup or corn starch, which are chemically identical, with no genetic material left, pure syrup, pure carbohydrates. Even those that have to be labeled. So if you make, say, a baked goods product with corn syrup from GM, corn is supposed to be. So the big cultural difference amongst European member states, the first thing I'd say, between the UK and the United States, I'm not so clear, I mean, just to take labeling, I mean, the FDA has a very clear concept of labeling, which is that stuff on the label has to be of use to the consumer in how they use the food product, right? So it's not about the right to know, it's about whether it can be some use. So nutrition labeling is useful because it may impact upon the way you choose to construct your diet. GM labeling, they say, well, it couldn't be of any use to the consumer because it doesn't affect the way you use the product. So there is a cultural difference there. In terms of safety, interestingly, the EPA, I know it's not the food regulator, but they regulate environmental risk. They are in general more precautionary than their European counterparts. Because in toxicological risk assessments, usually what you have is some data from rodents, which gives you the no observable effect level of some toxic, a PCB or a pesticide. And then you say, translating from rodents to humans, you multiply by a factor of something and take a, say, tenfold lower acceptable group level. And then you say, well, within the human population, there are babies, there are elderly people, there are healthy young men and women, so we'll add another factor of 10 to allow for that. So usually in Europe, we take no observable effect level, and then 100th of that is the acceptable level, let's say, for the pesticide residue on a piece of fruit vegetable. The EPA generally takes 1,000 as its correct. So, that does sometimes lead to slightly different advice, and it underlines my point about
reception that's out of tonight, where you also can interact with John if you want to.